everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center and have in studio on the political right, Senator Dan McKay.
Good morning, everybody.
And on the political left, Shireen Gourvani.
Hello, listeners. I hope you're doing okay.
I am fascinated, you two, by watching Marco Rubio in his new role as Secretary of State. I think he's just an interesting guy. He's kind of a prince-looking guy. You know, of course, he was a presidential candidate.
Oh, not like time. Prince.
Right. I use it to mean he's an Adonis. He's attractive.
Oh, really?
You know,
okay.
Young, all that.
Got it.
He's sensible to me compared to some of the people in the Trump administration.
I think that Shireen does not think Marco Rubio is
attractive. That's not my thing. That's not my thing.
Well, he met with a high-level delegation from Kyiv in Saudi Arabia to talk about what concessions we're willing to make, they're willing to make. They want security guarantees from the U.S. The U.S., of course, is after a mineral deal. Shireen, do you like watching Marco at the on the beat?
Watching him nearly disappear into the couch when we had the completely unhinged and deeply, I think, troubling conversation between Zelensky and Trump and Vance at the White House recently. I have to say, this has to be one of the most difficult positions that exists now.
I hope he's keeping a journal.
Yeah, my goodness. The tensions between, I would say, the world philosophy that he brings, which honestly I would say is more hawkish mm-hmm. than what we would see from Trump. And Vance has straight up said we should basically abandon Ukraine. So I think that there have to be some very strict competing ideologies around our engagement globally.
Yeah.
And that must be difficult to balance.
Yeah. Dan, when he was a rising senator, a lot of words went around the political class that he's on the LDS membership rolls. Do you remember this?
I do remember, yeah.
He's from Nevada.
I think he grew up LDS.
And in a low-income home that received a lot of assistance mm-hmm. through the local LDS bishop, and he was baptized. And
oh, wow.
I don't know if it's still, enforced that way, but just sort of an interesting local connection.
Yeah, local.
But Dan, we're talking more global. Anything on Marco Rubio's current leadership?
Well, I think it is hard when you're Marco Rubio, where you're used to being a senator, and then you go in and now you're Secretary of State and you're dealing with trying to negotiate what, really the president is and his agenda and trying to make that consistent. I remember reading in the Nikki Haley book when she talked about the difficulty of trying to balance what needed to move forward for the country versus mm-hmm. how the president's, edict would be and mm-hmm. trying to balance those two and make meaningful change.
Yeah, you're caught.
It's tough.
Yeah.
I think that's tough as a staff position. Usually as a senator, he's been able to go his own way.
Yeah, yeah, I feel it. Okay. Oh, Canada. I want to talk about Canada for a minute. The Liberal Party election has happened. Mark Carney has won. He'll replace Trudeau as prime minister. I've read a little bit about this guy. He's interesting to me because he's a banker.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they call him a technocrat, a globalist technocrat, who's had a role with the World Bank. He's been at Oxford and Harvard, well-educated at a Wall Street investment firm, Goldman Sachs. He's got his work cut out for him.
Yeah.
Between our country and Canada right now. And I heard a local commentator compare it to a German Shepherd and a Chihuahua.
Oh.
Just in terms of economic strength and size.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, no matter what, Canada loses in a trade war, but they can hurt us a mm-hmm. lot. And it's already started.
You saw the power, that Trump came out this morning and was talking about, we've allowed a significant portion of our country to receive its only source of power through Canadian influences. And why anybody thought that was a national security benefit just shows, there are risks, right, to foreign policy and trying to balance those things. And I think the Trump looking at the tariff, this shows in the power realm how they can cut, right? The long-term effect of this, though, will be, I think, it's going to be tough to watch for a while.
It's a lot of pain.
If you remember from the State of the Union, I think Natalie caught it too. This is an adjustment period, right? There's going to be mm-hmm. an adjustment period.
We're trying to do big things.
Yeah, we're trying to do big things. So there's an adjustment. And it's going to be interesting how these will play out.
I just can't let a mention of tariffs go by without again mentioning that what tariffs are a tax that American businesses and people mm-hmm. pay on goods that are imported. So when we think about the pain that will be experienced, mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend whose family is in like home building in mm-hmm. North Dakota, a huge amount of what they bring in are windows and siding from Canada. The cost that this is going to have to drive mm-hmm. up home costs, when we think just like there are so many impacts that will be felt by American people. And I really struggle to understand how the Trump administration will spin this to be to our benefit.
Sure. Well, so let's put this local, stay in the housing costs. I believe it's 30% of the softwood that comes into the U.S. comes in from Canada.
Yeah.
You can't like replace that supply chain very easily. I believe it's somewhere north of that in terms of gypsum that comes in from Mexico.
Yeah.
Gypsum's got unique qualities. There's not substitutes for it. Both of those go into home building, right?
Yeah.
I think that framing costs are the highest costs of a home. Mm-hmm. It's like 12% yeah. of the costs, and that softwood is the source for that. And so, Dan, elected leader's job just got harder. Because our housing prices, this is not going to help with our housing shortage and
thanks, Trump.
Price.
Well, and one has to wonder what the long-term vision is,
oh,
right?
You're
and
that's so right.
I'm just trying to step back and say, okay, if I get past the noise of the little announcements here and there, what is Trump trying to create, or yeah. where is he trying to go? And it feels like all of this is leading towards how does he get interest rates down? Mm-hmm. How does he get a stabilized economy that is more American supported as opposed to, you know, supported outside the borders? And I think those basically he's unwinding 20, 30 years of, you know, free market interaction with the world and trying to bring some of that back home to focus on, you know, and in some points, I think what the president is learning is that we in 25, 30 years have become so dependent really for production on so many things outside the United States that this adjustment period might be harder than he planned.
Well, this sounds like an argument or maybe praise of the CHIPS Act, which is nice to hear coming from you. But when we think about bringing...
I wouldn't
bringing,
go that far.
Oh, so we don't want manufacturing here, I guess. But the idea is that when we're bringing in, when we bring things home, there are some things like gypsum, like when we think about lumber, that like replacing that in an American industry is difficult, or it's a natural resource we don't
yeah.
have.
Shireen, you make a distinction there between a strategic tariff mm-hmm. and a broad-based one. So what Trump's doing is broad-based, right?
Yep.
He's putting it on a lot of things.
Yeah.
Whereas a strategic one has like a reason, like you're protecting a vital industry to our national defense or something. Yeah. And Dan, my face lit up when you said he's not articulating an endgame, because I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
If you're going to go through pain, you better tell people why.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's a, I mean, there's so much economics here, but the economic theory or principle is what we call comparative advantage.
That's right.
And when Dan says 20 or 30 years of global trade, there's a reason why that is helpful, because it maximized choice, it lowered price.
Right.
When you open markets, economies grow, they
yeah.
prosper. And what the president's doing by restricting it, by narrowing it, prices will be higher. You won't have as much choice.
And there's no question. I think the alternative, when you look at that, right, you now have created a dependency in some ways on some of this production. And I think that's what the president is concerned about, or what it feels like. But I will say, it feels like there are so many different levels of things that are going on. And it feels like the game is very advanced. One, I really do believe that you can't believe everything you hear, one.
Oh, interesting.
And two, okay. Well, I'm not saying okay. just from, I'm just saying from the press, from everybody, right? There's okay. a, you can't believe everything you hear. And whatever you believe is like, you know, your paradigm, I don't think you're going to be right.
Let me.
Right?
This is bleak, Dan. Let me give some
magnitude here.
Yeah.
So we import just over $18 billion worth of product to the state of Utah. Mm-hmm. $18 billion import. Mexico is $4.8 billion of that. It's our largest trading partner for imports. And the second largest is Canada at $3.1 yeah. billion. So Utah, little Utah, will feel the effects of this in a big way.
That's correct.
They're our two largest trading partners. That's why the economic outlook is darkened.
Yes. So speaking of that, well, I would like for us at some point to have a deep dive. And I know it's not really our job on this, but I bet you know an expert who could really talk us through NAFTA. Because for me, so many of the things that we're talking about now are spinoffs from decisions that were made or the policy, like when we entered into NAFTA. So I feel like there could be a fun episode for the real nerds out there.
NAFTA.
down
or the
road.
USMCA is what we'd call it now.
Yeah.
US-Mexico-Canada agreement.
Yeah.
Hey, recession talk. So in economics, we have something we call the subjective probability of a recession. Mm-hmm. And all of them put it out. It's subjective because it's not like data driven. It's a group of economists using judgment. But Moody's has it at 30% right now. This is a recession in the next 12 months. Mm-hmm. JP Morgan Chase has it at 40%. They just upped it from 30 to 40. Mm-hmm. Goldman has it at 20. Our group of local economists has it at 20%. Mm-hmm. I was with a group of business leaders this morning, the Board of Governors for the Salt Lake Chamber. You know, they're concerned.
Yeah.
There's so much uncertainty that you start to question whether you should hire, whether you should invest, whether you should purchase things. And it puts a pause on things. And then when the stock market does what it's doing, it has a wealth effect, affects consumer sentiment. I don't know, Dan. My recession meter's popping up.
Well, you know, 20% still means 80% not likely, right?
So, and in part, they're saying that because look at what this U.S. economy has done. It has blown through a lot of challenges.
That's exactly right.
Strong labor market.
That's why I do wish that the administration would say, here's our end game. Here's our goal. Here's what we're trying to do. And I really do feel like, going back to the campaign, I do feel like President Trump wants to see less foreign dependence for a lot of things, right? And there are some key things to national security that he's concerned about and would like to see them produced, done right here. You know, look at issues we've had with Chinese circuit boards and reporting back, right? Look at, you know, just overall energy dependence. And some of this stuff, really, we've kind of, it seems like we're forgetting the value of having some of those things homemade. Mm-hmm. And there's some push to do that again. Can the president pull that off in 4 years? I don't know. Mm-hmm. This is,
yeah,
and not absent serious change.
Huge risk here. Okay, let's wrap up this segment. But in the next segment, I do want to talk about Elon Musk for just a minute, and then we'll move on to local news. So okay, Stay tuned, everybody. Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gourbani and Dan McKay.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shereen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner, I'm in the political center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I mentioned I want to talk about Elon Musk just a little bit more. Shereen, I thought it was so funny when his big quote of the last couple of days is, most of the federal spending is entitlements. And I'm like, you think?
Yeah.
It took you that long to figure that out?
Yeah.
Just a reminder that the defense budget in this country is about $850 billion. Interest on the debt's about $900 billion, more than defense.
Right.
And entitlements sitting there at $4.1 trillion.
Yeah.
This is where I would have started.
That's why discretionary spending is
I wouldn't have gone after people's jobs, the workforce. I would have gone after changing the retirement age, you know.
Yep. I always, Mrs. Definitions over here. I know that we call them entitlements generally, but what we're talking about, Social Security is a system that people have paid into their entire lives, right, that are moving on to Social Security now. When we think about things like Medicare, Medicaid, these are critical safety nets that ensure that people, some of the most disadvantaged among us, have some sort of safety net. I've told the story before, but the reason that my mom, who was a single mom for most of her life, didn't lose literally everything that she had when she got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer was because she was old enough to be on Medicare. And we refer to them generally as entitlements, but these are programs that are central to the security and safety of many Americans.
I love how Shereen captures it. In public finance terms, we would use direct statutory funding.
There you go.
So what entitlement is really meaning is that we must do it according to law.
Yeah. Right.
We don't have discretion through the budget process.
Yeah. I was wondering when they'd get to entitlements. Right?
That's crazy.
It's like when direct statutory funding, is that what it is?
Yeah. He said, you know, when he said that most of the budget's in that, and I'm just like, why didn't you start there?
Yeah. Well, and you have to wonder a little bit, maybe it's political naivete that Elon Musk is talking from, because you heard Trump during the election cycle talk about how he wasn't going to touch Social Security and wasn't going to touch Medicare and leave some of those benefits alone. And so, you know, that's where clearly when you're talking about the trillions compared to all the other expenditures, I get it. The part that I wonder, and this is just not Republican lawmaker, get rid of principle, everything else, you have to wonder, we are providing healthcare for seniors in the most expensive way we possibly can, mm-hmm. right? And people are starting to wonder, like, are we doing it right? Should we be doing it differently? And I think that's the kind of stuff that Elon could be focused on, where we could start focusing the entire Medicare and Medicaid system, instead of being a fee for service, being a fee for care. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen a lot of those models out of IHC and yep. others mm-hmm. here locally, who've tried to focus more on care and less for mm-hmm. service. And we found significant savings in those at the state level. And is there a way to take that to the federal level and do some of those things so that yeah. we can get some of those savings? That's what I think would be very yeah. meaningful.
You're trying to keep people out of the hospital.
That's exactly
yeah.
right.
Yeah. I would just also invite people to read the book Poverty by America, which I feel like I've mentioned here before, but I'm actually re-listening to. It's by Matthew Desmond, the same person who wrote Evicted. There are a lot of opportunities, certainly, to look at ways that we might improve. I think value-based care, right, keeping people healthy is a huge opportunity. These are programs also that require upfront costs. Think about SNAP, the benefit that we have when people have food benefits and they're able to eat healthy food. It significantly improves, right, like long-term stability. But there's a lot of money that we leave on the table, and frankly, it's going to get worse when we continue to see cuts to the IRS. When we're not collecting the taxes that are due to this country, we are leaving millions and millions, billions and billions of dollars that could be going into these systems. So when I hear kind of this ongoing rhetoric about waste, fraud, and abuse at Social Security, I'm like, remember when we tried to get 87,000 additional IRS agents, and it felt like from the right, it felt like we were invoking martial law, right? Mm-hmm. And what we actually have there is a huge opportunity to make people pay, to actually go after the folks who should be paying into the government that don't or get around it.
Through fairness issues.
Yeah, fairness issues. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of dollars that we could be reinvesting here that would be a much smarter use of government spending.
Yeah, interesting. Mm. Hey, so Dan, I want to turn it to you and the post-legislative session, and I'll set this up by saying I spent so many years in the executive branch, and you work so hard to prepare the governor's budget. That's before the session. Then you follow everything during the session. But then you enter the veto period. And mm-hmm. so what I'm trying to get at is
my favorite part.
The poor executive branch never gets a break.
Never.
But now the governor's got, how many days does he have? Is it 30?
Yeah, 30.
30 days since the end of the session to sign or let legislation go into law without his signature or veto it. You've seen any vetoes? Is there any rumblings?
I haven't heard any. I think the governor is playing this very close to his vest. There are some bills that cause concern, I think. And so, I've heard rumblings of, you know, there was a bill, I think it was House Bill 516, if I remember right. And it was a bill that was aimed at the car manufacturers ran the bill with the, you know, House sponsor and Senate sponsor. But if they were aimed at, you know, Volkswagen starting up its own e-vehicle, you know, program, its own e-vehicle business, another brand. And then in taking that brand, they wanted to function outside the dealership model like Tesla does in the state of Utah, right? Mm-hmm. And they were planning to do that. Well, they, you know, wanted to come in and change the law so that Volkswagen couldn't do it because they have other brands and they have relationships. So those franchise agreement things, those are always tenuous.
Think the vote by mail is getting looked at close?
No, I think it is.
I say that because he was the former chief election officer and he's got, you know, the lieutenant governor now with him. And
I think it is, but I think the governor and the lieutenant governor's staff were involved in mm-hmm. the negotiations. I don't know that for
and
sure.
It doesn't
but
have an effective date till
2029. So I
that
mean,
softens it quite
there's
a bit.
Time for us to, you know, evaluate and make sure we've gotten it right.
Yeah, and you voted for that. So basically, yeah. to end vote by mail as we know it in this state, it's a massive restructuring.
Well, we ended vote in person with the same fanfare, and no one seemed to be that worried about it.
You could still vote in person,
right?
And then I think that one of the questions that I have is just like, can you help explain to people why this makes our elections safer or better?
Well, having a clean voter roll and making sure that we're not sending ballots out to people that aren't voting and aren't participating and aren't, like, you know, having a bunch of random ballots laying around is not a good idea, right? And this last election, we had almost 20%. We're just, you know, it's just sitting out there. And so the question was, is that the way we should do it? And asking that from a safeness, from a fairness, from a secure standpoint, it was, no, let's not overmail. One, it's expensive. And two, let's make sure people are verifying that they live here in Utah and that they have a, you know, that they're able to participate in their local elections where they're supposed to. I mean, I know there are several that don't, and they don't change their address and they still participate where they got their mail.
Yeah, I think there's just some really messy pieces of this. Like one of the things that I noticed that in some ways I think is good, right, which is the sense that instead of just putting, like, I guess it was the last four of your driver's license, now you can put your social security or different, just the administrative cost of changing that is also Herculean, right? And when we're thinking about now ballots having to be in by 8 o'clock on election day, which I think there's the nice thing about this is there's a long enough runway to really educate the public on this. Mm-hmm. But now we're also sending out letters. And if I remember, I don't have the number at the top of my head, but I remember the cost of the affidavit.
$6 million, if I remember right.
And the affidavit process. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about just the affidavit process to get people to verify at Salt Lake County when I was there is a lot. So we're talking about additional tax burden to fix a problem that wasn't broken, right? Yeah. So I think that that's really something that when we kind of talk about the efficiency of this state.
Let's put some numbers to it and then I'll have a perspective. The audits found that there were likely two people who had deceased that voted, and there was three people who voted twice.
Yeah.
So these are pretty small numbers. But I get we have to restore trust in Utah's elections. And the reason I say that is I'm not worried, but politicians hear from their constituents, and they must have heard enough about they're worried about the integrity of the elections to take action.
That's what I was going to say is there is a lot of chatter. There's a lot of conversation. We're hearing from constituents in town halls or whatever. But you realize where the bill started was no vote by mail and, you know, slowly eroded. You know, the process brought it to a 2029 effective date. It made more opportunities for identification to be, you know, to be ratified for the process. And I think all of those things are very, very valid. And if there's a way to accomplish a secure and a fair election that gets as many people involved as possibly can, I think all those things need to be balanced. And I think HB 300 is a great way to try and get all of those things.
So I just want to say, you said it started with no vote by mail. It did, but it also started with the Heritage Foundation. So some of the same people who were involved in Project 2025. So I just think that when we are told that these ideas are bubbling up, we should also understand that some of the most powerful voices that are in the ears of our legislators are groups like that.
That come from out of state, your point. I'm interested. Dan, we should get your wisdom.
Unlike all the money that's funding, you know, lawsuits over gerrymandering, which, you know, clearly comes from out of state as well. So that's not a problem, I'm sure.
Well, we need to talk about pride flags. And Dan, you have so much experience here because you were the person who had a failed attempt last session in the final hours to pass a bill like this. Now we've got Trevor Lee, who sponsored HB 77.
And you were the Senate sponsor, correct?
Yeah, yep. And banned pride flags from Utah schools and government buildings. I think I know the argument here, but give us color commentary just briefly.
You know, we were hearing from constituents, and believe it or not, I hear from people who call me their senator, even though they live in Salt Lake City. And they feel like there's a frustration with, hey, my government flies politically motivated material and displays politically motivated material all the time at their city building. I don't feel comfortable going into that environment. I don't agree with it. And their city, you know, or a city building or whatever, you know, a school, all those things should be politically neutral, right? And mm-hmm. having a political statements on the outside of the building, I mean, the Capitol, look at when we did a Ukraine, you know, thing mm-hmm. a couple of years ago, now politically unpopular, but did the Ukraine thing. They used a projection system. It was there for a couple of hours and then it was down, right? Mm-hmm. The idea of having content neutral on the outside of buildings is a big deal so that people mm-hmm. don't feel like their government is biased on one direction or another. The elected officials, on the other hand, you should not have the outside of the building or the building's, you know, nature of the building and its message be controlled by who the majority is of that building. Can you imagine a Trump flag on the Utah State
Could
Capitol?
Could I, as a state employee, still have a flag on my desk?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's not what folks who are working in government entities are hearing, just so you know. There have been sweeps through different offices asking people to remove their personal desk flags. So I think what you have to understand is the chilling impact this has. So I understand that people may not feel comfortable I don't actually understand in my heart why you would feel uncomfortable next to a trans flag or next to a pride flag. I think that it is, I've said this before, punching down on folks
it's
who are...
It's not about comfort. It's about the message
how is it
the
not
government
about,
is sending.
How is it not about comfort? Because what you said...
It's about the message the government is sending.
And what the government is sending, the message of those pride flags is you are welcome here.
And the message of the Trump flag up at the Capitol would be what?
Do you think that there's a difference between a Trump flag and a pride flag?
I don't think so.
Okay,
I think they are the same.
I think I would invite you into a world of creative thinking because there is a political
I'm
flag.
I'm all about creative thinking.
Yeah.
I've done it many times.
That's good. Well, this is a good discussion.
I just share with you the debate is there are several who feel like government
I will say
be
as someone
neutral.
Who's been in a, you know, advisor role to decisions like this, it is nice when the law is clear on something so you don't have to spend so much time, you know, debating something or trying to make a decision. The U right now, of course, we are not, you know, speaking out on public issues as an institution. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a nice thing for
the
people.
It's also a way that we comply in advance as we march towards further restrictions on our freedoms.
But nobody's stopping the professors.
We have to wrap this up, but Todd Weiler voted against the bill in the Senate. He's from Bountiful, represents, I would think, a pretty conservative. What was his take? And just really quickly, because we're out of time.
Well, I can't remember what Todd's take was specifically. I just know he represents part of Salt Lake City as well. And so, you know, maybe it's that constituency tie.
Okay. Well, great discussion, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gorbani and Dan McKay. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.